Turn to page 394.
Hey guys, why the long faces?
Who is that? That man?
He's a murderer.
Sirius Black has escaped from Azkaban prison.
Sirius Black is the reason the Potters are dead.
And now he wants to finish what he started.
I want you to swear to me you won't go looking for Black.
Why would I go looking for someone who wants to kill me?
Harry Potter.
There's something moving out there.
It was a Dementor, one of the guards of Azkaban, searching the train for Sirius Black.
It is not in the nature of a Dementor to be forgiving.
I hope he finds me. Because when he does, I'm going to be ready. You must look beyond.
Felt good.
Expecto Patronum!
From Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to the Potterverse. It's a podcast dedicated to the book and film universe of Harry Potter. So grab your favorite wands and time turners and let's step into the night to pursue that flighty little temptress adventure. Hello, fellow muggles and wizards and witches, wherever you may be. My name is Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And I don't think that there is a more cathartic, more like pleasing phrase on this planet than just screaming out with all of your might,
Expecto Patronum!
Like, that is a special, like, that you just get such a great release from that. Like, what a way to end that trailer.
Truly.
What, just like, they knew
they did done good with that trailer.
They knew that was a special moment.
Yep.
And that was the way to close out that trailer. Just excellent.
Concur.
Excellent stuff.
Concur, my love. Oh, well, here we are. For those of you who are brand new to the Potterverse, however you found us, whether through social media or through a podcast app, whatever it may be, if we're brand new to you, Blake and I have actually been going through the Potterverse books,
yes,
and subsequent films in order, and we just wrapped up Prisoner of Azkaban, the book.
Yes, we did.
Just finished it up, and we said, okay, it's time for the movie. So today's episode is going to be a movie review, but we will be sprinkling in differences. And I know that that's like a cardinal rule in Mary and Blake Media.
Yeah.
You know, the book is the book. The movie is the movie. But there is a massive shift between book is book, movie is movie, between movies one and two. And now three. So we would be at massive fault if we didn't mention some of the major things that changed in this movie.
Yes.
But that's to say, both have their merits.
And it's not like we're going to be talking about like, oh, he didn't say this line. But you know what I mean. We're not going to be nerds
Marauders.
About it.
You I know? May.
Like, we're Marauders. Gonna, we're going to... I think we're going to be focusing a lot, and I think a lot of the issue that this movie faces, and it's not even a bad issue, it's just one that it faces, is it has a lot to deal with. And instead of focusing on everything, it picks one thing and does it very well.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think you get a tighter film, one that is representative of what the book does, but not a wholly DNA carbon copy of it.
Not at all.
So, but I think that's a good thing. And we'll get into that conversation.
Yes. Well, before we'll get into it, though, we would like to remind you that our podcasts are sponsored through listeners just like you, members at jointhenerdclan.com. And as extra special treats, we do bonus episodes, book clubs, extra podcasts for our friends. And we actually did a live commentary track when we watched the movie yesterday. So we literally just like record, we put our phone in between us as we were watching the movie. And it's like you're there with us, particularly now while we're still in a pandemic. It's like you're having movie night in the Larson house. So, you know, check that out. If you would like to join, you could join for as little as $2 a month. We would love to have more friends at jointhenerdclan.com. If this is bringing Lumos in your time with the Nox. Mm-hmm. All right, Blake, quick question of the day.
Yeah, what do you got?
What do you most look forward to in this movie?
Oh, that's a good question, Mary. I think we've started off each of our film reviews that way, and I think it's fitting since we're coming off of the book. What was I most looking forward to?
Mm.
I was looking forward to revisiting how they handle the Shrieking Shack.
Oh, okay.
I think that was what I was most looking forward to, because my memory of it from the book is one thing, obviously, but mm-hmm. my memory of it from the film before reading the book was wholly different. And I this is one of the things I think that we were just talking about, where things go well and things are different.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this one's majorly different. And I think the movie fumbles a little bit. I think it fumbles a little bit
it
there.
Does.
But I was looking forward to seeing how they do it. And I think for the most part, for what they chose to do, they did it well. And that's it. How about you, Mary? What were you most looking forward to?
Better acting by the children.
Good point. Good point.
You know, for movies 1 and 2, you're just saying bless their little hearts. I mean, these are kids straight out of, you know, elementary school, barely having any acting experience whatsoever. And there were cringeworthy moments of acting in these films. Blake and I actually just were doing a lot of Star Wars stuff in conjunction with doing all the Harry Potter stuff.
Goodness gracious.
And we are just redoing the entire Star Wars series in numerical order, which is not how we normally do it. We usually do theatrical release, but we're doing numerical order now. So we started off with The Phantom Menace, and you're there and you're like, little Anakin, not the best actor. But really, when are children actors great? And I mentioned, so Macaulay Culkin was a great childhood actor.
Yes.
Forgetting his name again.
Which one?
The one from The Hobbit.
Oh, Hobbit kid. Elijah Wood.
Elijah Wood. Great childhood
Dakota
actor.
Dakota Fanning.
Great childhood actor.
Yes.
But this is like few and far in between.
Yes, I would agree.
You know, most
they
kids
are the exception, not the rule.
Yes. So, you know.
And like even Natalie Portman in The Phantom Menace.
Not great.
I ask you, no, I beg you to join us. Like, and you know what? Natalie Portman is an incredible actress.
She
won an Oscar, right? Like, it's not her fault. What you can tell is that it's one of two things. One, the writing, and number two, the directing. And both are the fault of George Lucas.
Well, yes, but here we are. You know, we're talking about Harry Potter. We're talking about Chris Columbus for the first two films, who was the director for the first two. He did a phenomenal job with all of these young actors. I mean, it's not like he just had one or two sprinkled in. It was literally a school of children.
And oddly enough, he was the director of Home Alone.
Yeah.
So
probably a large part because he had such success with a child actor. So, you know, I was excited because especially the core three, the trio, they've now had two big film experiences underneath their belt. I know that, you know, switching to a new director, he had them go through a lot of different experiences to help them better their acting abilities. And you can tell they grew a lot within these several years, but also their craft grew a lot. So I was excited to see that.
Yep, absolutely. All right, Marvin, you ready to get into this episode?
Yeah.
I mean, not episode, the film, our review of the film.
Our podcast episode?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, I got you. Before we do, we wanted to remind you to hit subscribe in case you're finding us on an app or social media. You can find us just by searching Mary and Blake, or you can head to maryandblake.com to find all of our podcasts and blogs. And of course, another reminder, if you find some Lumos in your time of Nox with us, feel free to contribute at jointhenerdclan.com. Let's get into the show.
I solemnly swear that I'm up to no good.
Oh, how apropos. How apropos that
buddy.
That sound plays.
Our podcast is like meant for Prisoner of Azkaban movie.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. Well, this movie, of course, is The Prisoner of Azkaban. It came out in 2004. Mary, I was a junior in college.
Mm.
No, I was a... it was like in between junior and senior year for me. So, yeah, I was a junior in college when this came out. Mary, were you a senior in college when this came out? Was this your first senior year or your second senior year?
Stop it. I didn't have a second senior year.
You know what I mean.
This is my senior year.
Yeah, it was your senior year.
I graduated in 4.
I thought you graduated in 5.
No.
Really?
I graduated in 4.
Oh, you graduated in 4, okay.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough.
I graduated... technically in December of 4.
Yeah, okay.
Of 4.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. All right, so the director is Alfonso Cuarón. You may not know that name, though you should, because he is, as you can tell from this film, an extraordinarily talented, extremely talented director. His past credits are Y Tu Mamá También, of course, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, the great, and I mean great film, Children of Men, the also great, and I mean great film, Gravity with Sandra Bullock, and the 2018 Roma, which came out on Netflix. It was actually nominated for a Best Picture, as was Gravity at the time. So he is a legit director.
Okay.
And he's not messing around. And he also actually directed 1998's Great Expectations as well. The writer, of course, is the same writer from the first two films, Steve Kloves. He has written every single Harry Potter film except one of my favorites, oddly enough, The Order of the Phoenix. That's the only one he has not written.
Which we like to call... emo Harry.
I know. He actually also wrote The Amazing Spider-Man, and he is now writing, or at least has written, because it's now wrapped filming, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them 3. So that is that.
Hmm.
Also, a little bit of a casting note for Fantastic Beasts 3. Johnny Depp no longer involved in the film.
Bye.
He has been replaced by Mads Mikkelsen. Who's
creepy too.
He is super creepy, man. And he is great.
Interested to see if they do something to the character of Grindelwald to make him have had a different face.
I feel like that's what's going to happen.
Like if he bippity boppity boos a Nicolas Cage face off.
Face off.
Expecto my face.
he like did Alohomora. Oh no, I'm sorry. Oculus Reparo wrong.
Oculus Reparo hold wrong. On.
Yes. Oh, you had an Oculus Reparo backfire.
It's all good, man.
All right, Marvin, your lightning bolt ratings. What do you got for your lightning bolt? How many lightning bolts are you given Prisoner of Azkaban?
Friends who are joining in live, we would like to know your rating on a scale of 1 being the worst, and 5 being the best. We would like to know. For me, this is a 4.9.
Wow. Okay.
It's a really good movie. Now, mind you, I gave... Chamber of Secrets a 4.8.
Yes.
So I've really only established like the most minute wiggle room.
Yeah. You know what? You jumped the gun a little bit.
Yeah.
You kind of like
Harry. I'm going to have to
kinda
have.
Kind of like Hermione in this one. Just jumping into things, not thinking about it.
Yeah. I think as we go forward, I'm going to not only just be in the tenths, but I'm going to have to designate things by the hundredths.
4.96.
Yeah.
Speaking of that. I'm giving this movie a 4.95.
Look at you!
This is the rare Blake is higher than Mary Bolt Lightning Bolt rating or anything rating in Mary and Blake Media.
Yeah.
This is the rare occurrence, ladies and gentlemen. Very rare. I really...
Pigs may be flying.
I really enjoyed this film.
Or Buckbeak.
I enjoyed this film so much on so many different levels. It's just superior craft, except for a couple of places. And I think we'll get into that in a little bit. But those little things that happen bring it down for me. It can't be a perfect film, but it is close. What do you got for your GBG, Marvin? You're good, you're bad, and you're great.
My good is John Williams' score. You almost don't realize that it's John Williams. The composer for the films does change a lot.
We're going to be talking about that today, too.
Yeah, but like the first two movies musically just feel a lot the same. The first two movies honestly feel like they could have been just one continuation of the movie in general. And then you get to this movie, and obviously different director, different feel, all this great stuff. But John Williams just goes wild. Like, he probably saw the night bus scene. It was like, all right, you guys ready to party? Because I'm going to make this sound like the most un-John Williams score ever. There are a few absolutely. Tracks that it's classic John Williams, but for the most part, he does some really wild stuff. And my bad is the Marauders. WTF, mate. We need a little bit more explanation. We need a little bit more connection to James. We need a little bit more understanding why and how people became animals. The Marauders map just didn't have the same feel or the connection, and that's a really big part. And I do hope that if there was ever to be a prequel made of the Harry Potter universe, the Potterverse, if one may, that it would be of the Marauders, because I feel like they were robbed on screen. Robbed. And then my great level up, everything. Acting, costuming, the world building, the music. They just took Harry Potter and leveled it up. Are there problems with this movie in regards to a lover of the book? Like a lover of the book? Yes. If you were to ask me which I prefer, book or movie, I'm the book girl. You're not.
You would
prefer the movie.
I think I prefer the movie, but it's a very tight decision.
Yeah.
It's
the same.
Yeah.
But, so I'm not saying that like, oh, this blew the book out of the water, but I'm just saying compared to the previous two movies, they just took it and I was like, this is what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Let's do it.
Yes, absolutely. For me, the good is the motif of time being explored throughout the entire film, whether it is the obvious time turner references or it is the more subtle references of the time and the seasons going through the film. The seasons are a big part of what happens in this film, and not because it's written or baked into the material, but because they make visual choices to show you the how time has elapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a subtle choice that helps supplement this motif, and that is furthered by constantly traveling in and out of the inner workings of the clock tower. At the school. And then not only that, John Williams' score also highlights the clock ticking when they're going through time. Mm-hmm. And they've gone back in time and they're doing everything at the end. This whole motif of time and how that is visually and audibly and also written into the film is it's masterpiece like mm-hmm. craft. It's excellent. The bad for me is a tie. First, losing out.
I love when the fact that you have two bads and yet this is a 4.95.
Well, you're not letting me get there, Marvin.
I'm letting.
The first one is losing out on the emotional catharsis of Prongs. That moment in the book where Harry says, Prongs. Like, that is a moment that is very special.
Agreed. Let's like light a candle for that moment.
It's very special. And there's a lot that happens in this film. And I think there's a lot of changes. And I can obviously argue all of them. Like, I can argue in the movie's favor for all of the changes. I think I would have an extremely hard time arguing in favor of cutting out that recognition of Prongs. I think that's really important. But if I were to argue against having it in the film, there is one argument I would make, and we will get to it. And the second one is, the exposition.
Same problem that was in the book.
Oh, the exposition in the meeting between McGonagall, Dumbledore, Fudge, and Madame Rosemerta. Yes, Mary, it is baked into the film because of the book. But that is not an excuse for this film, because the film chooses to do a lot of things different.
They're just like, underage wizardry being like a massive problem, but we're going to open this movie with Harry trying to do Lumos Maxima, like in his bed.
Right.
Underage wizardry in a muggle home.
Right.
Whatevs. We'll just let that happen. We'll just let Prongs just out the window. massive things.
Yeah.
But we can't tweak this totally awkward. I mean, they did tweak it.
They did tweak it.
Because in the book, Harry, Ron, Hermione sitting right on next to everybody. Yes. And everybody's talking about it pretty much in public.
But
at least
still,
either in a private room.
But regardless, the way that the information is divulged in the conversation, you know, exposition is, well, you know, we'll get in there. We'll get to it. Because I don't want to take up all the time in this. And my great is, oh, the exposition.
Hold up.
Oh, yes. The exposition between Harry and Mr. Weasley.
Okay.
That scene is it's one of the most powerhouse scenes in the entire film.
Walk us through why.
Because it is all done in one cut. And as you guys are probably well aware, Alfonso Cuarón, you may know or may not know that he is famous for, you know,
I did not know
long
this,
takes. And a long take is you have, you know, a certain amount of sequence that is uncut. There's no camera changing. There's no editing. There's nothing. It's just you start in one end of the scene and you fill that whole scene with no cuts. It's just the camera following people. And this is a real long cut. And I really, really, really like that. And how the information is disseminated, both, again, in the writing, but also visually. Very, very important. And the other great, of course, is creating a whole new visual language for this franchise. Alfonso Cuarón took Christopher Columbus's ideas and just said, you know what?
Of sweetness and merriment and anything on the trolley.
Yeah, like all of that is cute and fun or whatever.
Until a murderer from Azkaban is trying to get you.
Right, it grows this story. And it grows the story visually, but it also grows it thematically. And it grows it in a perfect way that represents the emotional turmoil that is happening in Harry. And that is why I think, and this is how I wanted to start off our conversation, Mary. I think the changes in this film are really good. And I think they're really good because the changes focus on one thing. Well, two things.
So there's like a lot of changes.
Right, but
you're just saying changes overall.
I think the changes overall, all of the changes can be in my estimation rooted back to one thing. It's I'm focusing on Harry and I'm focusing on Harry's relationship to Sirius Black in the immediate, not in the past, not in what he could have been or what was going to be. It's Harry and Sirius Black, and how are these two affecting each other at this moment? What is happening between the two? And because of that, this film is very mature, and it focuses very tightly. And if I think you tell a much tighter story, a much more efficient story, by focusing on just Harry and just Sirius.
Just Harry.
I'm just Harry. And that is why I contend the film, I think, is a terrific adaptation, because it does take a lot of the stuff that we all love from the book and just kicks it right out the door.
See, I will say it was a terrific movie.
Okay.
But when it comes to adaptation, it was good. I missed a lot of what I love in this book. So adaptation is a difficult word for me to say, but I truly, truly appreciate this movie as a film.
Yeah.
I just feel like you start to miss so many of the savory bits of this really, really magical, lovely book. There are some things, I mean, first off, they cut out my boyfriend, Oliver Wood.
That's true.
And they cut out my real boyfriend. Who's Cedric? Is that your boyfriend? No, my dear. We know. It's not really. They couldn't have had our paths in it
no,
this time.
No.
I'm just joking about him. But he is my boyfriend.
He is.
But I appreciate where you're going with this.
I think it's important to recognize what's important. Like what is important to the story that you're trying to tell?
Obviously not underage wizardry.
Well, no. And there are some...
You just need to have a moment, okay? Because that was established.
What?
In literally... Okay, the fact that Dobby lifted a cake floated,
yes.
Cake smashed, magic was done inside the Dursley's house. Harry got in massive trouble.
Yeah.
He's doing Lumos Maximus and nothing happens.
Right. That is an oversight, I think, to the logic of the world.
Or were they just like, whatevs. Oh, and Annie blew up his aunt. Whatevs about that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, but the way that I'm going to look at it is stats of a nerds. Like, whatever.
I'm like a nerd for life.
And you know, the film also does some other really cool things, too. Like, it builds out its world a little bit, too.
Oh, especially a lot.
When they get to the three broomsticks and he and Harry's staying, and you have the maid walking through and she's knocking on the door, and the whatever is just barking at her.
Yep.
Like, you know, little things like that. That stuff is important to the world as
they
well.
They did also alter the grounds of Hogwarts,
yes,
in this one. They moved Hagrid's hut physically down. You have to go down all these stairs. You know, they were able just to show Hogwarts in its physicality in different ways and tweaked things a bit. But it was fun because we spent time seeing the Hogwarts grounds. And you and I talked a lot about in our live commentary last night how you needed this so you could better understand the journey that Harry and Hermione need to go on back in time, mm-hmm, and that Buckbeak needs to take as he goes and rescues Sirius. So just to have that physical understanding of like the map of Hogwarts. And then we even get the Marauder's map. You know,
right,
it's just this really neat element to it. Fun little facts, though, because, oh, you know what? You keep leading because you were leading this one. So go.
No, I'm not. You can do whatever you want.
You got to do.
Oh, hey. All right, girl. I'm not necessarily leading. I just, if you want to say, we have some trivia.
You know, so they changed a lot of, not only the coloring of this, they made it so much darker and saturated more in the blue theme, but we got rid of a lot of the formalities.
Absolutely.
Of Hogwarts. Yeah. You know, even the kids, the students, their clothes. Yes, they wear their Hogwarts robes and their ties and all this stuff, but fun little things where the director said, you know what? Like, each of you dress in your robes and your ties how you honestly think your character would dress. Would they button it up all the way? Would they have known how to tie their tie properly? Or are they going to be Seamus Finnegan, who literally has a tie that's like 2 or 3 inches done? Like,
right.
He just obviously didn't know what he was doing and didn't care. So it's just fun to see their personality be interwoven, because that's how 13-year-olds would be at a boarding school. They don't have their mom or dad like checking their outfit before they leave. That you get what you get. And then when things are a bit more casual, they get to stay in their everyday clothes. And these everyday clothes that we get in this movie become the palette.
Yeah.
For which Harry, Hermione, and Ron's clothes will be in the future. Harry generally is in like blues and grays. And I was reading about how the costume designer chose that for him because Harry was the chosen one. Harry was Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah, you know what? You're right, Mary. I gotta play that. Hold on.
I'm Harry freaking Potter.
Like, he already felt like eyes were on him all the time. He's not going to be coming out in like super cool clothes all the time. He kind of wants to hide in the back shadows. Hermione leans a little bit more into her femininity, and she has a lot of pinks going on. And then Ron will be rocking a lot of like the red and orange and green, and always in these like totally awkward, probably Molly Weasley mean sweaters. Mm-hmm. But we're going to see them wear bits of those coloring and continue on through the rest of the series. Mm-hmm. And that color palette was really designed in this film.
Yep. And not only that, Mary, you're spot on about the color palette, because that blue hue, that blue hue, that filter that seems to be on this film is something that the franchise continues, I think, even straight up through Fantastic Beasts. That's due in large part to the fact that, you know, year 5 all the way through has since been directed by one director, and that's David Yates. Mm-hmm. And he is obviously a big fan of that feel. But the color saturation throughout the rest of the franchise, starting with this film, those colors are desaturated. I mean, gone are the days of the beautiful colors of the popping reds and yellows and the warm tones of the first two films. There was a slight maneuver, I think, from Chris Columbus in the second film to go towards more darker tones. But in this film is extremely happy to just live in blacks. The blacks in this film are dark and inky, and mm-hmm. there is no forgiving for the Blacks. There's no, there's you are either in, you're bathed in light or you're not, and that is exceptional. And that moment, I think, is best calcified or exemplified in the moment when Snape discovers Harry in the hallway. There is no light. There is, it is just Harry, Snape, and a wand that is emitting light, pulsating light, waves emitting from the tip mm-hmm. of Severus's wand. That is a really special moment because you get a chance that it not only does it speak a lot to how alone Harry is in this moment, but the tension is so wrapped up in how quiet and how dark and filling that black is in this moment. Really exceptional filmmaking. And that lasts throughout the rest of the film as well. There's dark, inky blacks even at the end where, you know, Lupin turns into the werewolf. You know, it's almost so dark that it's hard to, even though it is a full moon, it's almost hard to keep a track of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tale of a good director. When you're able to tell when and where you are in a scene at all times. And that, Mary, I think is the key to what you were talking about earlier, how they established the surroundings of mm-hmm. the school. They established the geography of the school. And not only, it's not just like these establishing shots that do it. It was done in a fun and interesting way.
Yep.
It was done in a way that you followed this bird. And the bird took you throughout all the places that you were going to, that at the beginning of the film, the bird took you through all the places that you're going to be going through,
mm-hmm.
whether it was the bridge or it was the Whomping Willow or it was high in the rooftops with Buckbeak eventually. All of these places are reintroduced to you and you see them in relation to other places. So you see the Quidditch field, where it is.
Mm-hmm.
You see Hagrid's hut, where it is. And if you're a smart viewer, you're recognizing that Hagrid's hut is in a different place
than the previous
films. In this film, it's on down a big, huge set of stairs that's rocky and it's hilly and really, really, really like excellently well directed. Like
I concur.
Stupidly well directed.
I concur.
The only part, though, Mary, is that was not well directed, I would say, is the big exposition scene, as we talked about with McGonagall. And also, it was a little clunky. It was a little clunky getting from Hagrid's hut to all of a sudden it was full moon and we're getting pulled into the Shrieking Shack.
Mm.
I would say that those two transitions and those two scenes are clunky. What would you say about that?
Yes. I will say yes.
If you are Alfonso Cuarón or you're Steve Kloves and you have to get this information out about Sirius Black being the godfather and how he hung out with James and Remus and everybody, instead of doing what they did, what?
It Harry, almost felt more believable. Like, it's so tough because it almost felt more believable in the book where the teachers are getting a little bit too tipsy and their tongues are getting a little too loose, you know, and they're kind of trying to one-up each other.
Yeah.
Oh, and I heard this and remember that. Like, they're just so excited. It's funny because, once again, what is so special about Madame Rose Murta that everyone just wants to tell this random innkeeper, like, all the deets? In the movie, of course, they do go to a private room. It is McGonagall, who I would have thought would have had her lips tight about this.
Right.
I don't know. And Fudge, once again, what's Fudge doing with these people? How would I have done it differently? That, my friend, is a fantastic question. I don't know. Like, part of me thinks, like, could it have been something that Harry was still under the invisibility cloak by himself, wandering through Hogsmeade, trying to find Harry and Hermione, and walking by Fudge and McGonagall whispering to each other, you know, like where they really think that nobody can hear. I don't know. But then it would have changed so much of it that people would have been really upset. I don't think this was an easy thing to fix. You can probably imagine the writer's room sitting there scratching their heads, ripping up sheets of paper. How are we going to do this without the fans wanting to kill us? This is so awkward. We have to have them say this. We have to have Harry hear this because this is what Harry's fine. Sirius Black wants to kill me? Fine. Whatevs. Voldemort's wanted to kill me my entire life too. What's another guy? Add him to the list.
Yep.
This is what ignites Harry.
Sure. That gets him pissed off. Mm-hmm. I'm going to kill him. You know, like that whole thing. You know, yeah, Harry has to hear the conversation and the conversation has to happen because without it, there's no way to get that moment of realization for Harry. Mm-hmm. The one where he says, I don't care what happens. I'm going to kill Sirius Black.
Yeah.
The issue that you face as a writer, and I think as definitely as a director, is anytime you have a scene that has these words in it, as you know, or you remember, if you have those words in a scene, you know...
Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
You've gone wrong. Because that is extraordinarily bad exposition. As you know, Mary, you have dark hair and it has some silver in it as well. You know that, obviously. I don't need to tell you, but I'm going to say it anyway. And why am I saying this, Mary? Because the viewers who are watching this need to have this information.
Like, you guys don't, but...
Yeah. That is bad exposition. And that's where I think films can go right and can go wrong, because films can do things that books can't do, right? Films can show you, instead of me saying, Mary, as you know, you have dark hair with some silver tinsel in it. I could be talking to you and the camera could move from me and then come around your head and show that you have dark hair and tinsel in it.
Okay.
As opposed to a book, which you would need a whole full descriptor of it.
Yes.
You know, and the book can elucidate a feeling where in one quick sentence, whereas a movie would have to take a full minute to give you that feeling, mm-hmm. right? Where I think film goes really right. And again, I will go back to this scene for exposition, because exposition in and of itself is not bad. It can be great in the perfect exposition. Of course, as we always reference in Mary and Blake Media, is Jurassic Park.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Classic. Mary, what scene am I talking about?
The Dino DNA.
That is all expository.
But so well done.
It's so well done because it's teaching you.
It's a cute little animated DNA.
At no point does it say, well, scientist, as you know, what we do is we... No, it teaches you in a fun, interesting way. The same thing happens... In a different way, but the same thing happens between Harry and Mr. Weasley. Mm-hmm. What do you before we talk about long takes and exposition, did that scene ever stand out to you prior to this? Or is that something that you ever thought of? And now that you the door has been opened on you, or the window has been opened for you about this
maybe
idea.
Maybe a window to the past, yeah.
What do you think about this scene?
It flowed completely different. If you take the exposition, like you were saying, this is one of your greats, this exposition dump. You're moving with them. You feel like because Arthur is maneuvering Harry around and making sure none of the other Weasleys can hear him, because he knows Molly's going to get mad if she finds out that he's warning Harry about this. But, you know, just moving throughout it and you're kind of getting distracted. It's super fun, you know, when you've watched it a million times like we have and you see everybody in the background. They're trying to slightly distract you so that you don't feel like this is a really long, boring exposition dip. It's like the rotating chairs in Jurassic Park.
Yep, absolutely.
It's like, okay, a bit of exposition, and now we're literally going to rotate you somewhere else so that you don't get bored, but we can still keep giving you this necessary conversations. Mm-hmm. So Harry and Arthur are in the very back of the room, and then they're coming up, and they're next to the next, you know, column, and the kid in the back is playing the little, like, wah, 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 oboe type thing and being a little snake charmer with a piece of rope. And then they're moving even more forward, and you see Percy getting cups of tea from a floating teapot. Like, it's just so great. And all the while, Arthur lowers his volume.
Mm-hmm.
And
as the scene progresses, it's getting lower and lower and lower and softer.
Yes.
Showing you how tense and how scary it is. And it's important that Harry is getting this information, and the long take begins with the beginning of this scene. You have the guy reading the book, and he's stirring his tea, and all the
while Weasley reading
kids,
a Stephen Hawking's book,
right, and Molly and the kids come running up. There's mm-hmm. Harry. There's Arthur. Then Arthur takes him to the side. He goes out to the back of the three broomsticks, comes up, goes in between some of the columns, comes back through the columns, up into this dark corridor, living in these inky blacks as the story talks about Sirius Black and how the story is getting darker and his relationship between Harry and Sirius's relationship. It's an incredibly beautiful long take. Mm. You know, there are very famous long takes. As a matter of fact, the movie 1917, we went to go see it in the theater, Mary, right before the pandemic.
Was that our last film we saw?
I think that was the last film we saw in the theater.
Yeah.
That whole movie is one long take. Now, in reality, it's not a long take because they hid the cuts. The film Birdman, also one long take. But in this situation, this is a real legitimate long take. It plays out like a play.
Yes.
And the whole thing, the Shrieking Shack and this, they both kind of mirror each other. Both condensed small spaces between a small group of people talking about these relationships. And in the meantime, and I think the film also does this really well too, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Sirius Black always has a presence in this film. Always. In one form or another.
Yes. Yes. I mean, we start off with Stanchion Pike on the bus.
Right.
Who is that?
He's a murderer.
You know, like laying it out. And then, as you said, you know, we continually see Sirius Black on the posters.
Right.
Or we hear his name said.
Right. And it's not always the same boomerang photo either. It's him like yelling, or it's him like looking very ominously. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's always a different photo.
Yeah.
That is also really
But then we
too.
Also have, when Sirius isn't present, we have the Grim present,
right.
which, of course, the big black shaggy dog is still Sirius Black. So whether it is premonitions that Harry's having of the Grim / Sirius, or if it actually is a big black shaggy dog,
yes.
his presence is strewn throughout the movie. And it's so interesting because this is the only film in the Harry Potter film franchise where Voldemort isn't in it.
Good point, Mary.
Good point. There's no Voldemort. There's no Tom Riddle. There's mentionings of him. But really, that is it. So you're sitting here as a viewer, if you haven't read the books, or you're reading it as a reader, wondering, where is Voldemort?
Right.
Who is this bad guy? I'm meant to be afraid of some kind of bad guy, some bad force. And it really takes you between the music and the Dementors and just the constant foreshadowing of the Grim.
Mm-hmm.
You fear Sirius Black.
Right, absolutely.
The music that is woven thanks to John Williams' score, where he has that double toil and trouble. I almost want you to have like bits of the score up, or I'm going to play it through my phone.
I got it.
You hear, it's introduced to you actually first through a choir. It's the only time that we like see a choir in Hogwarts, which is really, really neat. But he brings this double toil and trouble, which of course are words from the witches in Macbeth, just pulling from that Renaissance feel. And there's tons of Renaissance orchestration throughout this particular score, kind of leaning into that magical time frame of witches and wizards. But
here,
I got it
right here. Oh, hold on. Ready? Here we go. You get to hear that Renaissance right there.
Exactly. So we start to lean into this something wicked this way counts. And you can just keep it playing in the background. But you're going to hear this song throughout this entire movie. Something wicked this way comes.
Right.
And as viewers and readers, you know, you might be like, is it Voldemort? Is Voldemort coming? Who is this wicked thing? And even just that, dun, 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 that will be strewn in little bits. It's wild. So if you haven't just taken a night where you listened to the Prisoner of Azkaban soundtrack and listened for this song throughout it, I'm telling you, you're gonna be like, here it is again. Like,
right.
even if it's just for like 2 seconds, like it pops in.
It sets an an automatic tone, mm-hmm. one that is foreboding, one that is a little dark.
Little?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Good.
Toil and trouble, I think, is quite dark.
Something wicked this way comes. Yeah. Yes. You know, it sets up this tone, and it's not a surprise that this happens right at the beginning of the film, setting up this tone once Harry arrives to Hogwarts. Hold on.
Oh, they leave out the frog croak at the end.
Yeah.
How amazing.
But, you know, in contrast, though, Mary, in contrast, I have to bring up two other songs now that we're here at the soundtrack.
Please do.
We have to talk about Aunt Marge's song.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Aunt Marge's.
Bring it up, man.
The fact, like.
Let's just straight up. Can you bring up the soundtrack?
I got it right. I got the song. I got a couple of songs already prepped. The fact that this score.
It's one of my favorite in the entire series.
It's one of my, I think, my favorite scores of all time, actually. Oh,
yeah.
Because it's so different. I remember when Outlander Season 3 came out. Mm-hmm. The score from Outlander Season 3, if for all you
Outlander nerds. To the far Sassenach.
It's going from Scotland to Jamaica, and we're going 40
we're all over the place.
We have the Battle of Culloden, and then we have like Abindawe. Like, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the score for that season was everywhere, and it was wild.
Yeah.
Some of it felt a little disconnected, I think, in some places, but this score is definitely wild. Mm-hmm. And this is the first song, Aunt Marge's song. And you're going to hear the song and you're going to be like, is this the same film?
Is this Potter?
Is this really Harry Potter?
To me, this is John Williams.
Yeah.
Oh, a low brass person's dream.
Like,
it's like a circus.
It's a circus.
I mean, it's John Williams. You hear it, and there's no doubt who this is.
You can feel it. But it's wild. Like, it's a waltz, and you can picture, without even having to tell you what happened during this scene, you can already feel it.
Feel air flying, craziness, like completely.
Yes.
Outlandish things are happening.
And how it finishes.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
And hold on. This right here. This little.
Dissonance.
Yeah.
Da-da.
Like
you, that chord.
That last little chord.
Okay.
That, like, it sends shivers up your spine.
Oh, I took it as like hee.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
I took it as a laugh. Yes.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things, like, it shows you how off kilter that entire opening sequence was. And the direction of that sequence too, from Alfonso Cuarón, mm-hmm. you immediately got a sense of this is a different film.
Yeah.
This is a different total palette of everything we've been watching.
I mean, as I said, this song to me screamed John Williams. There's many pieces in this score which were very different from the influence of Alexander Cuarón. Like, just saying, okay, new director, new feel. For example, I don't know if you could pull up Quidditch.
So I don't have Quidditch, but I will.
In the previous films, dun, 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 oh, let me think how it goes. I'm going to like bring up there. Like, it's that theme.
Oh, very like.
It's regal, it's brass, yeah. it's you know, very proud and processional. And then Quidditch in Prisoner of Azkaban, which of course, you know, Harry's flying around. He sees the shadow of the Grim. We've got the Dementors. It's icy. It's chaotic. We haven't had a Quidditch match like this on screen. It's a little sad because Quidditch played a massive role inside the Prisoner of Azkaban. It's constantly in Harry's mind. He's got the guilt of his broom being all broken and all the practices that Wood takes him through. And then we hear this as the Quidditch theme. No. This is not Quidditch.
This says Quidditch right here.
Hold on. Oh, there we go. Bum, 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 bum. You're sitting here and you're like, oh, this isn't Chamber of Secrets.
No way.
Or Sorcerer's Stone Quidditch. Like, somebody might die in this one.
This is a Yeah, like you can feel the tension. And like
you go back to Oliver Wood first year, like, oh yeah, most people are fine. Yeah. I don't remember what happened to me because I blacked out and was knocked out and in the hospital wing. Like this is like, this ain't your mama's Quidditch. Right.
Here it is, like.
The sleet, the ice. Once again, very John Williams, yeah. Very Star Wars.
Oh, yeah,
like you could literally take this music
this
and close your eyes,
Star Wars, yeah.
And it just picture space fights. You know what I mean?
Yeah. This actually reminds me of almost the song "Revenge of the Sith," like the opening intro to
yes.
"Revenge of the Sith."
Yes.
It reminds me of that when they're flying in the space and like with all the different ships and they're shooting at each other.
Yep.
That's what that reminds me of.
If you could pale up for me. I don't know what next one you have on next. So once again, typical John Williams.
The next one I want to do, like this is very typical John Williams,
yes.
But different in terms of the.
No, this is Star Wars John Williams.
Yeah, in terms of the language, this is Star Wars and not Harry Potter.
Yes, yes.
But the one that I think is just out of this world, like
Night Bus. Oh, let's bring it up, baby.
Night Bus is. I don't even know how it's on the same album.
Well, and this is what's wild. I mean, he leans so heavily into the Renaissance music with the harpsichord and the recorders. And, you know, are you pulling Night Bus up?
I got Night Bus right here.
And as we're going to Hagrid's hut, like it's just a straight up recorder ensemble.
Yeah.
And then you have jazz moments when we're on the Night Bus, Lupin while we're doing Ridiculous, or even Lupin packing up at the end of the time. It's
right.
A little bit of jazz. But the Night Bus,
oh,
this is bananas.
I got it right here.
First off, all bass clarinetists are just...
You're freaking out.
Feeling their moment. You need to go a little further into this.
Oh, hold on.
This is like too much.
Once it comes, you're going to be like...
Just hold on. What?
There it is.
Is this the Wizarding World of Harry Potter? Oh, yes.
It's just...
This is like Michael Giacchino-esque.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Like,
just getting all that sax love.
Like the Incredibles
saxophone.
Almost.
Yeah. 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 I'm feeling it. So not John Williams feeling at all allows you to feel so off the entire time. Like you need to hold on tight because you're going along for the ride.
Right.
All the different orchestration that goes on.
All the whistles and the...
Yes.
And like everything. Like this is crazy.
Yeah.
And this is somewhat reminiscent of the cantina scene in Star Wars.
Ooh, yeah, I like that.
Somewhat reminiscent.
So one of my favorite pieces in this entire score, which is one of the reasons that I have issue, if you could bring up a Window to the Past.
Sure.
So Window to the Past, we are brought up with this theme. When Remus Lupin is on the bridge talking with Harry, and he's saying, you know, by the way, probably should have told you this a long time ago. I was besties with your parents. Really loved them. And he talks at great length about Lily and how much Lily helped him. And it's interesting in the movies is they lean so Lily, whereas the books are very half and half, almost lean more James Potter, mm-hmm. You know, in regards to the acknowledgement that he gets and the memories that he gets. So we get this beautiful theme called A Window to the Past, which you can bring up whenever you like, my love. Yeah, just bring it up. And so once again, we're using this recorder played very well. Not your third grader's recorder.
No.
This theme, many argue, should have been Lily's theme as we move forward, or had at least been, had her theme designed about it, because it is so beautiful and it is so longing. This is actually the theme that gets expanded upon as Harry says that final expecto patronum.
Right.
And you've got the whoom, like all this. But he is thinking of his parents. His parents is his happy thought that allows him to tap into prongs, to tap into, you know, saving his godfather, because it really is him thinking about the past.
But my counter argument to it would be Lupin is the one who makes that all work for him. And I would say that this is more Lupin's theme than Lily's theme. Here's the harpsichord again.
It pops in, though, when it's not just Lupin. It is Harry's memories of his parents, or Harry's
right, but
connection
Lupin,
to his
Lupin
parents.
Is the one who gives him the ability or unlocks the ability.
Lupin is actually
ability.
Jazz. So when Lupin is on screen,
yeah, no,
is Lupin.
I hear that. I hear that. Like, I get it.
Yeah.
But I, the way that I interpret this is, yes, Harry's thinking about his parents, but I also think that when this appears because Lupin is the one talking about his parents, and then when he finally does the big Expecto Patronum and there's that final
Which
movement,
is nothing.
It has this in
yes.
it, in that final thing. That's because Lupin is the one
who taught him it.
What to do.
Okay.
And that's why it
we
echoes.
We can agree to disagree on this one.
So I mean, that's, I'm not saying that's the answer, but that's what I think about no, it when it echoes.
I totally agree.
Because I love Lily's theme. I love Lily's theme as it's composed by Alexander Desplat.
I know, but I would have loved to have a bit of this. I think that having a bit more musical thematic symmetry throughout the films, in addition to Hedwig's theme.
Yeah.
Would have been nice. You know, here, right. dun, dun, dun. Like just bringing them in every once in a while would have been.
Yeah.
I love this theme. Yeah. So we can cancel
well,
this one
Mary,
out.
I want to ask you now that we've talked about Lily and everything and James, and you said, you mentioned how you thought it was unfortunate that they skipped over the Padfoot and Wormtail and Prongs aspect of the story. I do think there is a little bit of emotional resonance that is lost in the film when they don't talk about the Marauders necessarily.
You lose redeeming qualities of James Potter in the movies.
Yes.
And you also lose all of Ron's amazing moments.
Ron got the short shrift in this film. He got the short shrift in this. He got the business in this
Honestly.
Film. He definitely did.
He just became just like a comical afterthought.
Right. And the way that I felt like Hermione was an afterthought in Chamber of Secrets.
Yes.
But my argument here, and the one that I was going to state earlier in this podcast, Mary, the one thing I will say is that this film is telling a good story unto itself.
Yes.
It's not like, it's not like, you know, for you MCU nerds right now, it's not like the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where it's so dependent on what's going to come afterward. This film tells a good story unto itself. And there is a moment with the stag. And what you learn later on, you get enlightened later on, is that is Harry's dad. And like the stag aspect of it. And the beautiful part is Harry has the stag happen without the recognition of it at all being his dad. He just assumes that it's his dad because he thinks it's his dad.
The figure.
But the figure himself,
Patronum.
The figure that comes out of the Expecto Patronum is a stag, and it's not enlightened by his dad at all. It's just something that's within Harry. Harry discovers that himself as
movie
opposed
Harry
to,
doesn't know his dad's an animagus.
Exactly.
Doesn't know that.
Doesn't know any of this stuff, and it just happens to be a stag. And that comes out of Harry and not from somebody else. And that is the argument I would make against including the Marauders. Because eventually,
I don't think it's a good enough argument.
We do learn about the Marauders, and we do learn about Harry's dad and the stag and all the stuff. We learn about it already. So it tells a good story unto itself, but it's enlightened later on.
They don't learn it's a stag. He doesn't. Oh,
he figures it out.
All right. So we've just delved a ton into this, into all sorts of nerdy little nooks and crannies. There are fun little bits of trivia that we want to make sure that we include, but overall, a beautiful movie. Beautiful, beautiful movie. You can get some little popcorn kernels stuck in your teeth like I do about how they wronged Ron and, you know, the Marauders just not getting their due diligence. But when you separate the book from the movie, it is an extraordinary piece of film that really does set the tone for many things going forward in the Harry Potter universe.
Yep.
I do not like that freeze frame at the end.
I was just going to ask you, that was the last question I have for you. Freeze frame at the end.
Doesn't
Mary,
do it for me.
What are your thoughts?
Does not do it for me. I remember watching that being like, oh, that's weird. And then luckily the Marauders map comes in with the end credits and you're like, okay, I don't feel weirded out. A lot of people love that freeze frame. I don't.
The one thing I will say in defense of the freeze frame is the style with which with which the director chooses that the Dementors suck out their like their souls, their face blurs, and you can see the blur. Harry has his face.
It was supposed to be an homage to like another childhood movie.
Oh, okay. I don't know. But yeah. All I'm saying is Harry is full of soul and he's full of family and love, and his face is blurred the way that the Dementors were sucking out his soul. Uh-huh. But this is just his soul coming into himself. Like, this is Harry's life coming into himself. So do I love the freeze frame? No, I think it's kind of dorky. But I can at least make somewhat of an argument for it. So
As I said, it was something. It was like an homage to a growing up, coming of age movie that ended the same way with a freeze frame shot. I am just completely missing it.
That's
right
now. You can figure it out in a little bit. We got some trivia, actually, as we are always do on these films. Mary, are you ready for some trivia?
I would love it.
All right, here we go. I got some songs ready to play for you too.
You know, I want the like crazy flute when the bird is like flying through the tree.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's impossible to play.
Hold on.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do. Hold on. Give me a second.
I'm so excited for trivia. Friends who are tuning in live, you'll have to tell us if you knew this fact or not, or if you yourself know of any Harry Potter Prisoner of Azkaban trivia.
I'm trying to find.
Please add it to the comments.
Secrets of the Castle, maybe? Hold on.
You can just play any of them. It'll be fine. It's not. Oh, maybe. Oh, here we go.
It is.
Yes. This is no joke. Wicked hard.
This is the bird flying throughout the castle.
Yeah, here we go. This. The tonguing that takes place.
It's every flautist's nightmare.
No, but there was more. That was like a shorter version.
Well, that's what I got. All right, okay. So let me go back to the song that I was playing for our...
for our trivia section.
Hold on.
I was never able to find a...
Now I got a stupid advertisement.
If people just meet us for the first time right through this podcast...
They're going to be like, what are you like,
why are these people wasting so much time? Oh my gosh.
I know, sorry. All right, here we go.
Okay.
So we got some trivia. Trivia, as we are wont to do in our film reviews, because it's always just fun to look back at this stuff. In order to acquaint himself with his three lead actors and actress, director Alfonso Cuarón had each of them write an essay about their characters from a first-person point of view. Emma Watson, in true Hermione fashion, went a little overboard and wrote a 16-page essay. Daniel Radcliffe, like Harry, wrote a simple one-page summary, and Rupert Grint, like Ron, never even turned it in.
Brilliant. Well done, Rupert Grint.
A clause in director Alfonso Cuarón's contract forbade him from cursing in front of the kids at all during filmmaking.
Good.
I know, I'm just saying.
Well done, whichever parent added that puppy in.
Aware of his fondness for music, Gary Oldman actually presented Daniel Radcliffe with a bass guitar as a gift when they met for the first time.
That's awesome.
Isn't that cool?
So awesome. Well done. Gary Oldman, can't get much cooler than that guy.
Ian McKellen, the man that we all know as Magneto.
Thou shalt not pass!
Or, as Mary just said...
Gandalf,
hold on.
Nerd!
Ian McKellen turned down the role of Dumbledore.
Dumbledore 2.0.
Dumbledore 2.0.
Because, of course, Dumbledore was recast in this movie.
Having appeared as Gandalf in The Lord of the Rings, he said, I had enough trouble living up to one legend. Two would be too much to hope for. And he also stated that it would have been inappropriate to take Richard Harris's role, as since Richard Harris, before he died, said that Ian McKellen was a dreadful actor.
Oh my God, so mean, Richard Harris. And yet, yeah, I wouldn't want to fulfill that role either, if that's what was said about me.
Right. Originally, the script called for Hermione to only slap Draco Malfoy as opposed to punching him. Which, by the way, a fantastic moment in this film.
It's a real punch.
Yes, it is. During rehearsal for the scene, Tom Felton told Emma Watson to slap him. However, he had intended for her to not actually hit him, and thus was taken by surprise when Emma smacked him across the face as hard as she could.
Real.
Emma said that she felt terrible about it afterwards and didn't know what she was thinking.
She also had a crush on him during this time.
Director Alfonso Cuarón had never read the Harry Potter novels at all, nor did he see the first two films.
Then he did.
When he was offered the job of the director. It was Guillermo del Toro, another director who was good friends with Alfonso Cuarón, who convinced him, saying, "Don't be stupid, read these books immediately."
Good.
During the filming of the sleeping bag scene, director Alfonso Cuarón, Sir Michael Gambon, and Alan Rickman played a practical joke on Daniel Radcliffe.
Okay, so they're like walking the Great Hall. We've got the beautiful sky up above. All the kids are in the sleeping bags because yes. Sirius Black was somewhere in the castle. Okay, give it to me.
Dan had requested to have his sleeping bag next to a girl who he liked at the time.
Ooh, wink, wink.
And they played a joke on him by hiding a remote control operated whoopee cushion in his sleeping bag. And according to Alfonso Cuarón, the cut that is in the film is them using the whoopee cushion thing. And Daniel's trying so hard to just stay in character as everybody else is laughing.
Thinking he's tooting up a storm.
Yes.
Tooting like a...
Cuarón had the idea to have Harry and Ron and Hermione wear everyday clothes mm-hmm. more often than their Hogwarts uniforms in order to show more of the characters' personalities.
Love it.
And he also gave the rest of the Hogwarts students permission to wear their uniforms any way they wanted to in order to bring a greater sense of realism to the wizard school. Hence, some of the students wear the uniforms very neatly while others have shirts and ties and everything else hanging
It's a out. Real fun thing. Next time you watch Prisoner of Azkaban, yep. honestly pay attention to see how different they are styled.
The final Harry Potter movie to feature a score composed by John Williams, as a matter yes. of fact. This is the last one. He continued to be credited throughout the film franchise for the main motif, which is Hedwig's theme, which was adapted by the composers for subsequent movies. Many fans that wanted Williams to keep
Continue.
Going, but they never do. He never
Why
does.
Why didn't he?
I just think that he had other stuff going on.
But he's stuck with Star Wars.
That's true, but that's Star Wars, though. That's different.
No. But I'm okay with it, because I do enjoy...
To make the night bus appear as if it was zipping through traffic at an extremely high speed, the scenes were filmed with the bus driving at normal speed and the rest of the traffic driving at a snail's pace. The film was advanced, though, through the camera at a slower rate than it would eventually advance on screen. So when the scene was played back at normal speed, the bus appeared to be driving wicked fast.
I love that. Yeah. The bus, which was real, they really constructed it, right?
Yep. Cuarón had the idea to better establish the layout of Hogwarts to make it seem more like a real place and not just a group of sets. Mm-hmm. He says that they started linking spaces. You see that there's a Great Hall, and right outside the Great Hall, you see a hallway leading to you to the staircases.
Okay.
And then you take those staircases to the Gryffindor dorm.
Yep.
Or if you walk over the wooden bridge, you exit into a little garden of monoliths. And when you go past the monoliths down to the specific path, you get to Hagrid's hut. Essentially, the entire layout and structure of Hogwarts and its grounds were altered for this movie. And although most of it remained the same for the sequels, almost every following movie has introduced some changes to the castle or the environment to better suit its storytelling.
Well, just move the... I mean, hey, the staircases change. Other elements of the castle can change. It's yes. magic.
The tattoos on Sirius Black's body and hands are borrowed from a Russian prison gang. They're markings which identify the person as a man to be feared and respected.
I mean, he did a good job coming off like that.
The bats seen flying around in Hagrid's hut are real.
Yep.
They were particularly challenging to train, and Daniel Radcliffe noted that they tended to urinate everywhere.
Yeah, that's what bats do.
And the animal trainers kept the bats under control by using food rewards. They especially enjoyed bananas.
Oh, lovely.
Chris Columbus was originally signed on to direct all of the Harry Potter movies.
Could you imagine?
However, he realized that by doing so, he would miss out on seeing his children grow up and decided to pass on directing the subsequent movies. He remained on board for this movie as a producer, but after shooting Wrapped, he ultimately decided to end his involvement with the Harry Potter film franchise.
I need a life.
It's because he realized Cuarón did a way better job than he did.
No, yes, he didn't say that, but he needed a life. Harry grew up and needed someone a little darker than Chris Columbus.
The character of Gregory Goyle, while appearing in a few scenes, is largely absent from this movie.
Why?
This was due to Josh Herdman injuring his arm and being unable to film certain scenes. They brought in this other jabroni as a Slytherin boy. He's referred to as Pike.
When they're looking at the shrieking shack, it's like, who's this guy? I'll punch him anyway.
The author allowed Cuarón to make minor changes to the book on the condition that he stuck to the book's spirit. She allowed him to place a sundial in Hogwarts grounds, but rejected a graveyard, as that would play an important part in the then unreleased sixth book.
Yes.
The set for Honeydukes was previously Ollivander's wand shop.
What?
And Flourish and Blotts in Chamber of Secrets.
Flip-flopped. Nice.
Dawn French, who plays the fat lady in this movie, was, at the time, the wife of Lenny Henry. Who was that, you ask?
No idea.
He was the voice of the shrunken head on the night bus.
And this wasn't the original fat lady. Yep. They switched her.
Yep.
And they switched Tom, the innkeeper.
Correct.
Why?
The last Harry Potter movie to be released on a VHS is this film.
Do I have this on VHS?
I think you probably do.
I think I do too.
The geometric staircase at St. Paul's Cathedral, London, was used as the staircase that leads to the divination classroom. It was the only indoor area of Hogwarts shown in this movie to utilize an actual location for filming, as opposed to a studio set. The first movie made heavy use of the various castles and cathedrals around Britain for much of the areas of Hogwarts, with additional sets being built for the second movie. The lenses in Professor Trelawney's glasses, they were actually magnifying glasses.
Did she get headaches from wearing them?
And according to Emma Thompson, wearing them made her feel very sick and dizzy.
Yes.
And because he would be overseeing this movie's post-production work, Alfonso Cuarón declined
you
the offer.
You skip this. I can't be on that bus.
Fine. I can't skip it because it's all one song. He declined the offer to direct Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. Cuarón would have directed the Goblet of Fire if he wasn't doing the post-production of this film.
He would have done a wild job.
Right.
And I think he would have done the Goblet of Fire so differently.
I totally agree.
Because you've never read it, and that's our next adventure. That will be a question I think I'll ask you at the end of that book, is how would he have directed this?
And then here's one that is going to upset you, Mary.
Oh,
the
dear.
Last one. Michael Gambon, who played Dumbledore, admitted
later on... Did you put your name in the Goblet of Fire?
Oh, well, this is going to play right into that, Mary. Michael Gambon later admitted that he saw no point in reading the books to get an idea of the character of Dumbledore, since every part that he plays is just a variant of his own personality.
Oh.
So during the whole course of playing the role of Dumbledore, never read a single book.
Didn't he, though, before the sixth movie?
It says here that he never read them.
Well, I thought he finally did, because people were like, you are doing such disservice to our beloved Dumbledore. Get your acting gear, be sweet and whimsical, and not be crabby and creepy.
Yes, so that is the final bit. Oh, also, the kid that played, what's his name there?
You're very helpful.
Dudley.
Oh, yes.
Lost so much weight that he had to wear a fat suit.
Yes.
In this film.
Yeah.
So, just to keep up the appearances. That is that, Marvin, for our...
they almost recast him.
Yeah, right? Isn't that
really
crazy?
You're too skinny. You're supposed to be Dudley.
Have some cake, will ya?
He's like, I don't know, I just grew and I stretched out.
So that is that, Marvin. That is the end of our trivia.
Okay, awesome sauce.
And I think that should do it then.
I agree.
We should close it out after this.
We're going to wrap it up.
We're on an hour 12 already.
We had a lot to say.
A lot to say about
this.
This
was a shorter movie than Chamber of Secrets, though.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
Fun little things that you get to see within the Marauder's map. If you're looking at it, while Harry's looking at it originally, you actually get to see Newt Scamander walking inside Albus Dumbledore's office, which is a fun little thing as we get into the Fantastic Beasts series later on. And in the end credits...
Mm-hmm.
If you look really closely in the bottom left-hand corner while they're like saying like so-and-so's name did this and so-and-so's name did that, there's this little corner alcove where there's two pairs of feet.
Mm-hmm.
One feet is facing outward. One feet is facing inward. A little like wink, wink, nudge, nudge to maybe people are hooking up.
Oh, okay. All right. I gotcha. Look at you. Look at you.
Looky to whoever made that little piece. Little nod to adults.
All right. Let's close this bad boy out, shall we?
We shall.
Let's do it.
We want to thank you so much for tuning in to this here, the movie review. Note that we will be doing this for all the subsequent movies, and starting next week, we will be delving into the first chapter of The Goblet of Fire. And this is Blake's first time ever reading The Goblet of Fire. So if you yourself are a Harry Potter fan, you can do us a really huge favor. We want to have Goblet of Fire bring in like this big fanfare. We want everybody and anybody who's been a Potter fan to jump on board and say, all right, I'm going to do the Potterverse. It's one chapter a week. You can show up live on Facebook, YouTube, or Instagram. We generally go live on Thursday nights.
Yep.
You can also sign up for a complimentary text reminder service. So if you have your cell phone in hand, you can write this down. You can remember it, whatever. It's the phone number 81010. And in the message field, you're going to do the @ Elderwand, all one big word. So the @ Elderwand. It'll sign you up for a completely complimentary text. If you're outside the U.S., you go to remind.com/join/Elderwand.
Oh, that's it, Mavin. I think you did a good job.
Well, you did do.
Yeah.
My name's Mary.
My name's Ida Goblin of Fire.
Mischief managed.